Okay, so our next speaker, Sharon Sidowinski, is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Information and Media Studies and the Center for the Study of Theory and Criticism at Western University in Ontario. She is the author of Human Rights in Camera, Chicago, 2011, and is currently working on a book about the social and political significance of dream life called Dream Matters. So, Sharon, please.
Thank you. I was so interested in your question, actually, Christine, because I found Peter's talk very distressing. Having written a book all about atrocity photographs, it gets worse and worse to look at them and to look at those photographs again. A bit, to sort of hear them described as banal was distressing. Okay, let me start with an image. The photograph is one of a series published by the U.S. military in recent years designed to specifically publicize the community building, reconstruction, and social welfare projects that it supported in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's one of several pictures that were taken by ordinary servicemen and women in the course of duty. Publishing these kinds of images is part of the American military's evolving counterinsurgency-related information operations. I first came across them when they were published in the latest issue of the journal Humanity, which included a small section of these photographs as part of a special dossier that it, a really interesting dossier that it published on militarism and humanism. But I want to speak about this image for a moment, which shows Air Force Sergeant Joe Laws letting a local child from Kapisa province in Afghanistan look through his camera in August 2011. I want to take this image as emblematic, or somehow emblematic, of the topic today, which is photojournalism and war in the digital age. Or if I could put this in my own terms, I think we should use this image as a kind of place card for the changing photographic situation that is contemporary wartime. And my aim will be to say something about what it means to describe war as a photographic situation, or rather, what a sustained thinking about photography might yield for our understanding of contemporary wartime. I should warn you off the top that my approach is going to be different from the frame that the organizers have given this event. But then again, one doesn't get so many opportunities to speak about these things publicly, and I kind of want to make the most of my chance. Let me also take a moment to thank the organizers of the symposium, Dr. Christine Ross for the initial invitation, Ms. Mary Chin and Theodora for the 1,000 tiny details that you had to put up with. My warning is about the fact that I intend to take great liberty with two of the key terms under discussion today, photojournalism and war specifically. If what is generally understood by this phrase, photojournalism in war, is images that depict war in some way, I intend to speak instead about the ways in which we might think about the time of total war, in which we find ourselves thrown, as a photographic situation. So this is to say I'm keen to trouble these two terms. Such trouble doesn't come just from me, of course. Mary Favrette has been busy disturbing our understanding of war for some time, and some of her thinking has been recently published in a book called War at a Distance. And Favrette is a professor of English at Indiana University, and her book is ostensibly about the literature and art of the Romantic era, so it seems in some ways really far from our topic today. But Favrette persistently, indeed urgently, asks what war means to a population whose armies are almost constantly engaged in military conflict, but almost always across the globe, and rarely, if ever, on home ground. What is important about the book is the way that Favrette shows how, despite the distance of the battlefields, the experiences and feelings and memories of a home population, the civilian population, are nevertheless radically shaped by warfare. She patiently shows how the literature and art produced in Britain during the late 18th and early 19th centuries was obsessively preoccupied with cultivating the means for feeling and understanding the wars that were being waged far from home. Favrette distinguishes the experience of those living through but not in war by what she refers to as wartime. Favreau herself borrows this term from Paul Fussell, the monumental, the historian who wrote the two monumental books about the First and Second World War, respectively. And as Fussell himself says about the Second World War, the one that he served in, the damage war visited upon bodies and buildings, planes and tanks and ships is obvious. Less obvious is the damage it did to intellect, to discrimination, honesty, individuality, complexity, ambiguity, and irony, not to mention privacy and wit. Like Fussell's interest in the psychical damage of war, in the damage that does not register in the visible world, injury that is not directly photographable, Favreau is interested in how modern forms of war are experienced by those who are not on the battlefield, how war is either passionately felt or how it barely registers in the substance of the distant civilian's everyday life. It never ceases to surprise me when I talk to my students that they're not aware that their own country is at war. So wartime refers, therefore, to the modern experience of war from a distance, which, as Favreau shows, was made ever more possible throughout the 19th and 20th centuries by the channels of the mass media. And although her book is principally about the Romantic era, it is, of course, written with an eye to illuminating the present. And indeed, as our own country's engagement in Afghanistan now crosses the 11-year mark, the longest in Canadian and indeed U.S. history, it has become abundantly clear that we are trapped in another period of wartime, which is to say, surely more and more thought must be bent towards grasping this long war. How disquieting to our notions of humanism and post-humanism, globalism, the new international, indeed to intellect, discrimination, honesty, individuality, complexity, ambiguity, irony, privacy, wit, to think that this new millennium has been one of almost constant military action. With this perturbing and gnawing thought in mind, I propose to borrow Favreau's thesis in order to put pressure on the frame of our discussion of war today, here. Apart from considering the changes to warfare in the digital era, urgent thought also needs to be given over to thinking through the changes to wartime, which is to say, the changes in how war is felt and thought from a distance, and how our new forms of media both shape and limit our ability to think and feel war. One of the particularly slippery aspects of Favreau's work lies in her discussion of the way war manages to invade thought itself, how war is constantly threatening the very grounds of our capacity to think and feel. War does violence to bodies and buildings, but it also does violence to our more intimate modes of being. Indeed, one might go so far as to say that the primary target of all war, indeed perhaps of all violence, is the human mind. War targets the inner life, the ways of making meaning, of making sensation. It makes damage on the register of the soul. It sounds kind of old-fashioned to talk that way, but I think it's indeed the domain of the soul that I'm interested in today. To even speak of civilian life, for instance, is always already to be speaking in proximity to war. Civilian is, after all, a category that is proximate to soldier. It's a term that first emerged in English during the Napoleonic period, which is one of the key historical antecedents to our own era of total war, a period which saw the deadly shift in the nature and aims of state-sponsored armed conflict, when war first began to draw on the entirety of a nation's resources and took as its object not only military supremacy, but also the total annihilation of the enemy. Our changing language of war also speaks so loudly of wartime, of the way war manages to invade thought and feeling on the home front. And perhaps our exemplar here can be made to speak to this, for although this image ostensibly depicts two civilians and a soldier who appear to be somewhat proximate to the battlefield in Afghanistan, the picture was designed in part to be displayed and regarded at home in the United States, far from the battlefields. According to Niles Gilman, the editor of the dossier that was published in the journal Humanity, he didn't actually say, it's not discussed in the publication, I had to actually write to him and sort of bug him about it to get this information, but as he told me, he said, the journal's editorial collective selected these images from several websites in which the soldiers have uploaded photographs, including the U.S. Army's own photo stream on Flickr and Facebook. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you that the military establishment creates and encourages these venues precisely so they can vet the images that soldiers are making and circulating as their own means to combat the release of the more damaging self-depictions that Peter talked about, the Abu Ghraib prison photographs from Sabrina Harmon and others, the videos of soldiers urinating on Taliban fighters that they've just killed. One of the worst ones, when I was with Carrie, I didn't hear about it until that damn panel. The puppy. There's a video of a U.S. Marine throwing a puppy off a cliff in Afghanistan. I do not urge you to watch that video. So these sites are attempts to manage wartime, to attempt to manage wartime affect in particular, which is our experience of war from a distance. But they also signal something about the shifting strategy of contemporary warfare. If so much of 20th century was dominated by total war, perhaps these pictures testify to something else, to something that's been started to be described as partial war, which aims not simply for the total capitulation of a political opponent, but rather to win the sympathies of a contested population through counterinsurgency, reconstruction practices, aid, and so on. At least this is what the editors of the journal Humanity suggest by scrutinizing the links between contemporary militarism and humanitarianism. And indeed, this picture speaks much more of a kind of 19th century notion of colonial war rather than a war of total annihilation of the enemy. Or at least this is what we may witness here in the disquieting intersection of humanitarianism being implemented alongside military force. This tightening of the relationship between militarism and humanitarianism animates beyond the borders of the battlefield. Indeed, virtually all the images probably discussed throughout the symposium today might be considered to be objects of wartime, in Favret's sense, since all are designed to transmit something of war to those who are not in it. As Susan Sontag famously noticed, being a spectator of calamities in another country is the quintessential modern experience. And in this, Sontag leaves unclear whether she is speaking of military or humanitarian activities, calamities rather, a distinction that is becoming more and more difficult to parse. But let us hold on to Favret's point to recognize that the spectator's constellation of thoughts and feelings about such photographs, the complex emotional situation that these pictures arouse in us, should itself be thought as one of the key sites of wartime. And in this respect, Favret's approach allows us to add another layer to our questioning. Apart from how does mass media represent war, her notion of wartime allows us to ask how the circulation of such images is itself a means to wage war. But then there is more. Because of the radical, I don't know what to call it, except the radical promiscuity, I guess, of social media websites like Flickr and Facebook, the images posted there can be put to ever new uses. In their republishing of these photographs, the editors of the journal Humanity took inspiration from the situationist idea of détournement, taking the officially sanctioned products of the propaganda apparatus and repurposing them for other ends. This brings me to my second revision. I want to use this photograph as an exemplar of our topic, photojournalism and war in the digital age, because the image in all its myriad uses that it can be put to poses a question about our common understanding of what photography is. Or in other words, it poses a kind of challenge to the assumed ontology of this medium. Not much has been written on this topic, of course, but generally speaking, photography is thought to be the activity of photographers making photographs. And more specifically, photojournalism is understood as the work of professional photographers who make photographs in order to communicate news events to the public. And Peter's already put pressure, I think, on that definition. This conventional definition puts emphasis, however, on the subject wielding the camera and aligns this figure with the more familiar notion of a journalist. And I want to suggest that this conventional set of ideas about the medium actually obscures a more radical notion of what photography is. Indeed, unlike the print journalist who authors a text, the photographic situation involves a variety of human and non-human subjects playing any number of roles, but within which no one subject possesses sovereign control. Or as Ariella Azoulay has more elegantly phrased it, no one is the sole signatory of the event of photography. Although the photojournalist's name often appears in proximity to his or her photographs, here it's the Associated Press photographer Narciso Contreras, who gets credit for his picture, which accompanied a story in the New York Times last week, this traditional authorial gesture actually belies what photography encompasses. So rather than produce a more and more nuanced analysis of photographs as texts or as photographer as author, what perhaps is more urgently needed is an understanding of photography as a situation, as an ongoing condition rather than a specific event, as a situation which involves a range of subjects and possible outcomes, a condition that has no definitive beginning or ending, and indeed which can occur even without the presence of a without the presence of a photographer. And this, of course, the CCTV cameras in London, which I saw an estimate recently, it said there was something like 4.2 million CCTV cameras in London, which is insane, really. And it's interesting that here you have the removal of the photographer from the photographic situation, which puts more and more pressure on the the deployment of the gaze. Interestingly, Banksy's, I love Banksy, so I threw Banksy in, his recent take on the London situation. The ubiquity of the CCTV devices might be one of the most powerful and radical proofs for Roland Barthes' venerable claim about the death of the author, or here the death of the photographer, which paradoxically is a gesture which puts all the more pressure on the gaze exerted in the photographic situation. And then on the other hand, the photographic situation can occur without the presence of spectators, and Peter already mentioned this. Here, photographs of the coffins returning home to Dover or Air Force Base, photographs that were made but not allowed to be shown. And they were banned starting in 1991 during the first Gulf War, the Persian Gulf War. And these were photographs that were only released after a lawsuit, the Freedom of Information Act lawsuits in 2004. So here you have a situation where there were photographs but no spectators. They weren't allowed to be seen. So just as Mary Favret makes a plea to expand how we think of war, we need similarly to expand our frame of thinking about photography. And in fact, a close group of my colleagues and friends, a longstanding research group, some of which whom are here, which goes by the name of the Toronto Photography Seminar sometimes, we've begun just such a task. And so far we've come up with seven theses, seven short aphorisms that try to capture something of the changing photographic situation. My original title promised to speak to these seven theses, but I realized I really just wouldn't have time to do that today, and nor really perhaps would you want me to, because they were designed, it's a joint project, and it's designed to capture the range of work occurring in photography studies, and I thought it might just be best to keep really within the confines of my own research today. But let me say a little bit about, they're all online. If you really want to see the seven theses, you can find them on our website. But I did want to speak about a little bit about them. So here's the first one. They're kind of in homage to Walter Benjamin, of course, his own thesis on the philosophy of history. So here's our first one. The photographic situation is a conceptual framework that defines photography as much more than a technology for producing pictures. As theorists from Benjamin to Azoulay have made evident, photography should rather be understood as an ensemble of diverse actions that mediate relations between people. Its ontology, therefore, is political. And at the dawn of our digital age, with the dramatic transformations wrought by this revolution still ongoing, we can perhaps see anew the remarkable advent of modernity that photography engendered. Like today's digital technology, early photography radically transformed the very grounds upon which the production and circulation of scientific and philosophical knowledge rested. It was a watershed. With the discovery of the daguerreotype in 1839, a new species of vision was materialized, a phenomenologically photographic form of seeing. And it was sort of assumed, actually, in Peter's talk, that we now see war through images, which is to say that we don't trust our own eyes. So it's important to remember that that's a new way of seeing, to kind of quote John Berger there, whose book Ways of Seeing just had its 40th anniversary, actually. To bring this closer to the question of war and wartime, one of the most disquieting ideas to emerge during the same period of human history is the belief that the most effective way of waging war involved the obliteration of civilian life. And although this dream of total warfare has existed for centuries, as I already mentioned, its roots began in the Napoleonic era, this particular doctrine took on new potency at the beginning of the 20th century with the development of aerial bombardment technology. Airplanes would utterly transform the future of war by transforming the location of the front. The technical evolution effectively erased any distinction between soldier and civilian. And as one of the early theorists of air war chillingly proposed, nothing man can do on the surface of the earth can interfere with a plane in flight, moving freely in the third dimension. The destruction wrought from above was far beyond human scale, and hence a challenge to the powers of the imagination. Air war transfigured the dimensions of the battlefield and simultaneously dealt a blow to the human capacity to communicate and imagine. The very first substantial expression of modern air war occurred when Germany's Condor Legion bombed a small Basque town in the northern part of Spain late in the day on April 26, 1937, Guernica, the bombing of Guernica, of course. It provided a kind of prime target for Germany to test out its new air war capabilities. This preliminary military exercise helped the Nazis develop their Blitzkrieg tactic. And in addition to the bombs that ravaged the town's buildings, machine guns took the fleeing civilians as their target. Remarkably, news of this attack reached international audiences almost immediately. The Times carried a front-page report on April 27, 1937, by George Steer, and photographers were immediately dispatched to capture images of the destruction. One of these pictures manages, this is now about May 8th, about a week later. Nevertheless, one of the pictures manages to capture flames still licking through the remains of Guernica's marketplace. It's become one of the icons of the bombing that was taken on, as I said, May 8th. And I'm not really the photo historian that Professor Gervais is, and so I don't have the page layouts, which probably would be important to know the context. But I can tell you that by April 28th, photographs of dead women and children were published in the communist paper La Humanité. By April 30th, images of the bombed-out town appeared in a variety of Parisian papers, which Pablo Picasso was known to have read, and his first sketches for the now famous Guernica date from May 1st. And in one of the masterpieces of wartime writing, Virginia Woolf describes receiving a package of these pictures in the Morning Post. She was on one of the mailing lists for the Republicans. In Three Guineas, she reports that one photograph shows dead children. Another shows a section of a house. A bomb is torn open the side. There's still a birdcage hanging in what's presumably the sitting room. But the rest of the house looks like nothing so much as a bunch of spillikins suspended in midair. Wolfe's essay offers a portrait of what this war felt like from a distance. So if yesterday Professor Gervais is interested in the formal aesthetic construction of the photographic arrangements within the press, I'm interested in the aesthetics in the older sense, the aesthetic aesthesis, the nature of how the human sensorium receives stimulus, the sensual impact of these images on the world spectator. One could read such aesthetic encounters as exemplars of what Jacques Rancière calls the redistribution of the sensible, which is to say new organizations of the sensory world that can refigure the landscape of what can be seen and thought and felt. If air war wreaked damage from the third dimension, how remarkable was it that photography was called upon to combat this violence through its networks of distribution, its capacity to generate an international alignment of witnesses to offer a venue for the world spectators' shock, censure, and grief. There is surely much more to be said about the relation between these new forms of violence wrought from above and photography's ability to help weave a new community, a sensus communis, from below. Photography could not defend against the damage done to bodies in buildings, planes, and tanks, but it somehow helped defend against the damage that war visits on the soul. From the very beginning of this new era of total war, photography offered a special form of civilian defense, a kind of defense by representation, what Sigmund Freud might have called Reizschutz, a protective shield for the mind. This remarkable use of photography in times of war continues to this day. The unconscious dream of total war, the fantasy of obliterating a civilian population in the third dimension, might be said to have reached a particular kind of climax on September 11th, 2001. Here, airplanes themselves became the bomb and the front, and the indiscriminate destruction of civilian life could itself occur up in the clouds. While much of this event, known as 9/11, unfolded as an image, much of it remained in the domain of the non-reprehensible. Representatable, and as many have noted, inaugurated a crisis in the notion of the imaginary itself. This recent disaster, what has been called the most photographed event in history, has sparked much reflection on the relation between air war and the visible, and most specifically, that vexed means of producing and reproducing the visible domain, namely photography. And then once again, photography was called upon as a form of civil defense, as a potent means to combat this form of terror. One of the most compelling projects to emerge during this time was called Here is New York, a democracy of photographs. Shortly after September 11th, four friends, a professional photographer, a gallery owner, photo editors, decided that they had to do something to document what was happening, what was still occurring on the streets of New York that infamous fall. The group immediately decided that their makeshift project should be open to, as they put it, anybody and everybody. And they sent out word as widely as possible that any photograph submitted on this topic would be displayed in an exhibition at Michael Shulen's Soho Gallery on Prince Street. Images began pouring in. 5,000 photographs were submitted in all, taken by some 3,000 mostly amateur photographers. Volunteers carefully scanned each submission, reprinted the photographs uniformly so they could be hung floor to ceiling, like so much laundry drying in the alleyways of Naples. Here's New York is an exemplar of the photographic situation because of its implicit challenge to traditional photojournalism. Built into this archive is an understanding that the repeated circulation of a small handful of professional photographs is not enough, that more is needed to combat the damage done to the emotional and intellectual life of New Yorkers. As Shulen himself writes, whereas the other events of this kind of magnitude, one striking picture has sometimes come to stand in for it, to symbolize it. These photographs were captured with every conceivable kind of apparatus, from Leicas, and digital Nikons, to homemade pinhole cameras and little plastic gizmos that children wear on their wrists. The archive also poses a challenge as traditional photography at the level of form. The collection has many faces. It initially took shape as an exhibition. It's traveled to several exhibitions. It became a huge exhibition catalog. The whole thing is now online as an archive. It's got these strange categories. My favorite one is the one called Onlookers. You can search for images based on these strange terms. It's in direct response to the radical new forms of waging war. People found new ways to construct and use and transform the photographic situation as a means to defend against it. Let me just add one note about the importance of the materiality of the image. The U.S. military... Well, that's not the image I wanted. Well, you can see the materiality of the images here. The U.S. military seems to have quickly caught on to this strategy, to the idea of generating a so-called democracy of images, evidenced by their Flickr stream or their Facebook page, although perhaps we'd want to see this as a kind of pseudo-democracy. However, among other things, what remains different about Here is New York is not only that they accepted and displayed every image that was submitted, but also that they printed them. There seems to be much meaning held in this extra step of processing the digital files into material objects. If one of the most significant transformations in the digital era is the reconfiguring of the traditional photographic process, the material chemical process, into digital data, one of the consequences is that the material object, the printed photograph, has begun to slip out of view. And perhaps one of the most interesting questions to pursue is this old one about the force of the encounter with the material object. Perhaps along these lines, Walter Benjamin's signature claim about the political significance of the destruction of the aura begs renewed attention. If photographs might be thought of as fragments or better ruins of memory, so to speak, then they are in need of translation in Benjamin's sense. They need to be deciphered and placed in a living context for them to become meaningful to the present. And something about the actual process of printing and handling these images is conducive to this emotional work, what we might think of as a kind of soul work. Okay. The other thesis that I want to talk about is the sixth one of the seven theses, and it's my favorite one, and so I wanted to spend some time talking about it. The various participants in the photographic situation usually do not have an equal role. However, no one individual or institution can clearly claim control or mastery over the photographic situation. In part, this is because photography, as Walter Benjamin noted, is marked by the presence of das Es, the unconscious, or simply it. That would be the best, most literal translation of Freud's term, das Es. Benjamin's description of the optical unconscious suggests, in one hand, that the potential for photographic vision has not been exhausted, but more radically, that its force will belie any effort to master the event of photography it shows. This aphorism refers to one of the most compelling, if opaque, observations that Benjamin, one of the signature theorists of the medium, makes in 1931. In his little history of photography, Benjamin writes, "It is another nature that speaks to the camera rather than to the eye. other above all in the sense that a space informed by human consciousness gives way to one informed by the unconscious. And I was, as Peter was speaking, I think that the image that probably speaks to this most out of his collection that he brought is the one from Syria of the bomb, the sequence with the bomb, the tank bomb exploding. Benjamin's thought is repeated in his magisterial work of art essay, which I'm sure almost everyone in this room has probably read at one point, if not more than once. And here he expands the thought. He says, "It is through the camera that we first discover the optical unconscious. Thanks to the camera, therefore, the individual perceptions of the psychotic or the dreamer can be appropriated by the collective perception." For Benjamin, photography is not simply a technological extension of our senses, in Marshall McLuhan's sense of media as prosthesis. Rather, it is an altogether other nature that speaks to the camera. Benjamin is suggesting that what Freud called das Es, or more simply it, shows itself to the photographic apparatus, just as it is evident in our dream life and in delusion. What makes this concept, what to make of this estranging and strange idea? How does this notion of the optical unconscious demand a revision in our conception of the photographic situation and the relations therein, in particular under pressure of war? Benjamin seems to suggest that there's another agency in the photographic situation that hasn't yet been taken into account. But what's tricky about this proposal is that the unconscious refers to a category of meaning that is distinct from subjective experience. It does not function like sovereign or state power, nor does the unconscious speak in the first person. It can't be claimed. Benjamin isn't entirely alone in his suspicions that the unconscious animates the photographic situation. Throughout the entire history of the medium, photographers have continuously marveled at what their cameras produce, seemingly by accident or otherwise without intention. And sometimes practitioners share Benjamin's suspicion that beyond what is presented in any picture, the photographic situation also discloses a dimension of reality that cannot be seen per se. Celebrated photojournalist Susan Mizellis describes the idea this way. She says, "The question remains as to whether or not you can make images that will actually inhabit you. We, as makers, are the ones going out there trying to figure out where we can be, where to stand, what to hold, what we can do. This is a very different part of the process from how we read images. I'm preoccupied by the question, can we become haunted by images that we haven't seen or haven't made?" Now, at first glance, Mizellis's question appears to be about how the force of an event can be transmitted through the photographic apparatus, how a spectator can be deeply affected by a photograph of political violence, for instance. Netta's, I had a student who worked on that video of Netta's, and I just cried the entire semester. How a spectator can be deeply affected by a photograph of political violence, for instance, without having witnessed the event directly. Mizellis cites two photographs as example. Richard Drew's Falling Man, and her own terrible picture of a corpse, a dismembered corpse from Nicaragua called Cesta de Plomo. Both images produced a profound response in spectators when they were publicly circulated, and there's been a considerable analytic effort to articulate their power since. For my part, however, I would like to interpret Mizellis' statement as not only referring to the difference between witnessing war in person and witnessing it in a photograph, but also as a tacit acknowledgement of this other nature, which speaks to the camera rather than to the eye. In other words, part of the power of the photographs that Mizellis names is how they manage to evoke the unconscious, an image role that is not directly visible to the eye but nevertheless exerts terrific force. Mizellis's comments about being a maker of images are instructive in this respect. Perhaps it could be said that at times a photographer relinquishes control of the photographic situation to the unconscious. It may not necessarily guide them where to stand, what to hold, what to do. However, this other nature nevertheless plays a significant part. On September 11th, for example, Richard Drew found himself outside the Chambers Street station in Lower Manhattan, shooting pictures of the jumpers while standing between, as he put it, a cop and an emergency technician. And it wasn't until he got back to the Associated Press office when he was looking over his own images that he recognized, as he put it, what only his camera had seen. Something iconic in the extended annihilation of a falling man. He didn't look at the other pictures in the sequence. He didn't have to. He says, "You learn in photo editing to look for the frame. You have to recognize it." So Drew performed his role in the photographic situation, deciding where to be, what to stand, what to do, all seemingly without knowing what would be captured, what image worlds would sear the apparatus. As Drew himself admits, it can only be recognized later. Leaving aside the question of professional competence, this seems to be one way to articulate how the unconscious inhabits the photographic situation. Part of the situation operates in excess of intentionality, in excess of any given subject's will, indeed in excess of anything one could call subjectivity. Some aspect of the photographic situation occurs at the level of a thing, it. And in fact, accounts written by professional photographers are often rife with its uneasy traces. This is my last point. In his memoir about working as a photojournalist during the last years of apartheid in South Africa, Greg Marinovich, here Greg's on your left, describes a terrible scene that he and his late colleague and friend Kevin Carter, on the right, experienced together. Although the impact of this event registered differently on the two men, one might say that both were inhabited by this particular event's image world. Although the aftermath, the way that inhabitation, to use Mizalis' term, haunted the subjects afterwards, played out differently for each of them. The story is a complicated one, and let me just read to you, or you can read for yourself, from Marinovich's account. This is kind of a long bit here, but I think it's important to take it word by word. Kevin was having a beer at a pub opposite the Star where they worked one Saturday afternoon when Zhao, another colleague, came in after covering an uneventful political funeral. After several more beers, Kevin recounted a recurring nightmare that was plaguing his sleep. In the dream, he was near death, lying on the ground, crucified to a wooden beam, unable to move. A television camera with a massive lens zoomed closer and closer in on his face until Kevin would wake up screaming. Kevin thought the dream meant it might be time to leave photography. When Kevin told me about the same nightmare some time later, he described the feelings of helplessness, the anger, the fear he lived through in that dream. It was all he imagined our subjects must feel towards us in their last moments as we documented their deaths. The dream had variations. Sometimes Kevin was the photographer, not the victim, and in that version, the dead man would roll over and grab him by the ankle, holding him captive with bloody hands. Some weeks previously, in a lawless Sowetan town called Chicken Fall, Kevin and I had been following armed policemen as they ran. The dream happened. Now Greg is reporting what happened just before the dream. Kevin and I had been following armed policemen as they ran through the shacks, plunging downhill along rough tracks muddy with raw sewage. At a clearing near a stream, we saw a woman in rural Zulu dress, wailing in grief, her hands clutching her head. In front of her, a middle-aged man was lying on his back, arms outstretched on either side of him along thick wooden beam. It looked as if he had been crucified. His earlobes, pierced and enlarged in the traditional Zulu fashion, were filled with blood from several head wounds. There's no question that a professional thrill ran through me. It was a scene that could be an icon of the Civil War. Kevin and I descended on the corpse, but once we started to photograph, I found myself struggling and failing to capture the image of the crucifixion properly. I was unnerved, jittery, my hands were shaking involuntarily. Perhaps it was because of the woman wailing, or memories of childhood religion of Christ on the cross. I looked at Kevin, he looked stunned. Suddenly the corpse groaned and rolled onto its side. We leapt back in terror, we had been so certain that he was dead. I will never forget that moment of horror, but unlike Kevin, I had no nightmares, at least none that I could recall in my waking hours. Now, perhaps I don't need to tell you, but Kevin Carter took his own life in July 1994, shortly after the elections which effectively brought an end to the era of apartheid in South Africa, a fact which brings new poignancy, perhaps, to Santayana's famous statement that only the dead see the end of war. But how to even begin to speak of this terrible scene in the so-called hostile wars near the end of apartheid? It is something of an understatement to say that being proximate to war can be involved being faced with occurrences for which there is no sense and no accounting to be made. But it can be noted that Marinovich's story differs from Richard Drew's, in that what is at issue here is not an instance when the camera sees something that was not otherwise directly recognizable to the senses. Marinovich admits his frustration about failing to capture the scene photographically. In this case, then, the optical unconscious did not speak to the photographic apparatus. Rather, this example seems to be closer to the connection Benjamin himself makes to those other diverse aspects of reality which lie outside the normal spectrum of sense impression, the perceptions of a psychotic and the dreamer. We're still in the supersensory domain here, although this time it was not captured mechanically. Instead, it is Kevin Carter's recurring dream that offers evidence of the presence of the optical unconscious, as if some part of the photographer's own mind functioned like a light-sensitive plate, recording otherwise unseen aspects of this dreadful event. In this instance, the optical unconscious inscribed itself directly on Carter's psyche, and the nightmare perhaps represents the beginning of a dialogue with this other force that left its imprint on the young man at the level of his being. Marinovich's remarkable vignette quickens any number of questions that I won't be able to answer, and I'll leave you with them. How to account for the different experiences between the two photographers? How to differentiate the various levels of meaning at work here, the signs, a dying man's gesture, the symbols, the crucifixion, the symptoms, the recurring nightmare? How exactly to characterize the modes of representation through which the optical unconscious makes itself shown? How does it speak, and how is it heard? And how to consider the politics of this force? Which is to say, how to account for what this agency does to our social and political relations, and especially in times of war. This last question calls for a revision in the very concept of the political, let alone the photographic. Taking the optical unconscious seriously suggests that there is much, much more at stake than the well-worn question of what ethical role photographers play in recording or disclosing moments of political violence. Marinovich's perturbing account suggests that there's something else in operation here. There's another nature that quietly animates and inscribes our fields of actions. Or as Susan Mizales puts it, how are we haunted by images that we haven't seen or haven't made? In the context of the optical unconscious, Mizales's question can be seen to be disturbing our thinking about the very nature of political authority in times of war. Who authors these image worlds that haunt us so? A question to which Benjamin might have answered, it does. Perhaps it's strange to end a discussion on photojournalism and war with an image that can't be seen or shared. It's interesting that Peter and I both ended on this question, an image that can't be seen or shared. In this case, with nothing but a war photographer's nightmare. But then it seems to me like this is the best testament to what war does, how it leaves us disturbed and undone, how it agitates us at the level of our soul. This troubles the image of the human as a secure or autonomous creature. Instead, speaks to a more and fragile and precarious form of interrelationality between us. And perhaps this is what war exposes, all the more urgent then to consider the photographic situation. Thank you.
We have some time for a couple of questions.
There. I was interested in your Here is New York portion. I was thinking of Lev Manovich, and so he talks about the database and the narrative as sort of an oppositional frameworks for contemporary, I guess, archival imagination, you know. And what I think, I mean, this is less of a question than whether you agree with this, but that gallery show collapsed those two things. It was simultaneously database and narrative, mm-hmm. and the way it achieved that was through materiality. But I don't know.
Yes.
You've emphasized how photographic images change the way, or have changed, the way we think both about war and wartime. But you don't really discuss what those changes are. In other words, what did they used to be and what are they now? Are they collective? You also leave open how much of it is collective and cultural and how much of it is individualistic. There seems to be a tension between, on the one hand, it's very personal, but on the other hand, you suggest it's also a product of its particular social structure. So I'm wondering if you can perhaps fill in a little more about what these changes are that you see and how much of it is social.
Was it you yesterday that asked where we're going?
Yes.
Who are you? Is this another way to ask that question? I don't know. You know, it changes day to day how one thinks about these things. And it's what's interesting about emotional life is its shifting nature. That, you know, you can be sad one day and then you feel hopeful the next. And so it's really hard to sort of chart a trajectory in the Kantian sense of a teleology of human history or something. And I would be wary to do so for all the reasons that Kant was. But I'm a bit worried, frankly, about... I'm still upset about Peter's talk, to be perfectly honest, because it's distressing to see the circulation of these images in a way that feels careless. Not that Peter was careless, but that there's just like, you kind of feel a barrage of them in a way that it's like, it's hard to parse the emotional events, each one of them. And I think each one requires a kind of emotional parsing. It requires a kind of soul work, an emotional work. And it's like, you get tired when it's just another one. And I think that's my version of what Sontag says. I think the question of desensitization is kind of a false topic because it takes a lot of work to remain to hold emotion at bay. It's a very active position to be apathetic, oddly. But I guess today I'm a bit more worried about where we're going. I'm going for a drink later. That's where I'm going.
We have time for just one more question.
I have so many questions, Sharon, but I think what I want to ask is about how does turning to the photographic situation help you answer the questions people are asking about the relationship between the database and the narrative? I think is really interesting because the work of collecting things or aggregating things online, I don't think are about a lack of care necessarily, but we tend to read them as it because they don't come in the same kind of context we're used to encountering them in. So does thinking about the situation, because it seems like you're wanting to shift the location or the way we think about the scene of photography and the scene of photography's production and dissemination. Mm-hmm. How does that give us access to what you're saying is the kind of emotional weight or the kind of burden of witnessing, I think, is what you're getting at, that move from seeing or encountering an image to taking on some kind of responsibility for it?
Yeah, I mean, it allows us, in a very practical way, it allows us to talk about, you know, what is the work that the guys that were printing and hanging those photographs in the galleries in Soho, Michael Shulin's gallery, do. And that might, in fact, be where a lot of the action happens in terms of the emotional processing of what is going on the streets of New York. So it takes a little bit of the pressure off just the photographers. I have a lot of questions for Peter, actually, because I'm more interested in the kind of the reception of the images that he talks about. The image he showed of the kids on the lawn of the White House after Obama announced that they'd gotten Bin Laden, to me is where is a place to begin doing the work of the photographic situation, because it's about the reception of those images, and as much as it's about the accumulation of archives, the ordering of archives, the putting images to new kinds of uses, but it expands the range of how we talk about what photography is. That's not a very good answer to your question, but we can talk more later over drinks.
Maybe.
I was intrigued by the discussion of the unconscious of the professional photographers. I'm wondering, do you think there's a difference between the kind of unconscious of the amateurs and the professionals? Is there a particularity to kind of the professional photographer's unconscious and framing as a result of that due to training, due to experience, et cetera?
I don't think it's not the unconscious is different, but that oddly, that training, photographic training and experience as a photojournalist might impede the outbreak of the unconscious, whereas it's probably much more evident in amateurs' relationships to the camera. And so, you know, Freud would be interested in all the slips of the tongue, the parapraxies, all the sort of accidents, which is probably more evident in the amateur images. That's not a different unconscious, it's just a different manifestation of it, which inhabits, yeah. You probably find it in the outtakes, I would say, of all the photojournalists' works.
Thanks, Sharon. You can be done. We're going to take a half-hour break now and recommence at 3:30 with Donald Matheson's lecture. On va recommencer à 3h30 avec la conférence de Donald Matheson. Merci.